Scrolling for May 30th, 2023. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. It is graduation season this week, Chip. Everybody is graduating. Congratulations to all of those kids who are matriculating.
Matriculating, Steve. We should remember that word. There may be some kind of trivia somewhere.
Matriculating is a great word. Maturing is not necessarily along with matriculating. They're just moving on. Go on, kids. Go on. Congratulations to everybody.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. It is summer movie season, and you, sir, you have gone to go see the latest and greatest from Walt Disney. This is The Little Mermaid.
Is this a part where we put our plug in for Alamo Drafthouse once again?
Thank goodness.
Seems like that theater is just right around the corner. And yes, they had a presentation of The Little Mermaid. And I decided, because I was like, oh, I got a few hours. What should I do? Let's see if we can get a ticket to see this show. It is sold out all the time. They had a show every half hour. And I found like a single seat sitting between some people. And I went to see a late night showing.
So they call this the live action version of the animated classic, The Little Mermaid. But I would argue that this is still animated. It's just a different style of animation.
Yeah, I think the best way to describe these are different productions.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be the best way to do it. I don't know why they're doing these. The one that was presented in 1980-something mm-hmm. that basically saved Disney animation. Because Howard Ashman came in and said, hey, you know all those movies that you're not really doing real well with? You forgot, these are musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically started writing the music and some of the songs for it, put together, I would say, I don't know, do you want to say maybe a third of a musical to be able to produce that?
I would say it's more than a third. I would say that the focus of what he was able to do is create stage plays that were then animated. And when we produce those musicals on stage, we focus a lot on those Howard Ashman shows.
But you're only looking at 2 to 3 songs. I mean, you're looking Part of Your World, Les Poissons, and probably 2 or 3 others. You had to add a lot more to that. They eventually did make it into a Broadway musical, but they had to come in and flesh that out to make that Broadway musical. This is not a production of the Broadway musical that The Little Mermaid eventually became. This is a production of the movie and the music that they put together. Along with, I didn't realize this until I'm sitting there in a song going, that's not Howard Ashman. That was Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote a few songs for this. Of course he did.
Of course he did. He is the influential music maker of the 21st century so far, for sure.
So there's a couple songs in there. Immediately you go, oh, that's different than Howard Ashman. Both of them are incredibly skilled people. We have Melissa McCarthy, who's playing Ursula in this. This is a career-defining performance.
Hmm.
We will know her as this character. She fits this character so well. Our director, I don't know how he reeled her in, because Melissa McCarthy is all over the place.
Was
like over joke? The top.
Did you just make a fish joke reeling her in?
Yes. But really, just the she's over the top. Mm-hmm. She's kind of bombastic. Right around the level of Robin Williams type of reeling in to be able to get the performance.
Agreed.
And they did get her. This is a tight production. She is really, really good. Her makeup's great. Her presence is great. Her song is great. Like I said, this will define her career as what, if not her best performance, it will be, you know, her career defining performance. I mean, this is this is the one that they'll go, oh yeah, she was Ursula. By the way, Ursula in the animated film, the original one, was based off, do you know who? It was based off of John Waters' friend, Divine. It was based off Divine.
I did not know that. That is news to me. That makes sense when you say that.
All right, so we have Halle Bailey. Let's make sure we get that right. That's so
difficult, Bailey. Isn't it? Halle Bailey really needs a different stage name, because yes, everybody that tries to talk about this movie accidentally says Halle Berry. No, that's not her. It's a different person.
So Halle Bailey is truly the all-American girl. She is our Little Mermaid. She's Ariel, and she's wonderful in this play. She's got the American smile. She's got like the presence of this American kid who's today. Certainly the packed audience was eating her up, okay, as the, you know, she's a fish, Steve.
That was another fish joke. Yeah, I was going to say that.
As Ariel, she did a great job. Sebastian is played by David Diggs, who is also known as, I don't know, Thomas Jefferson, Steve.
Yes. Featured in that Hamilton movie, where Lin-Manuel Miranda certainly has his influence all over this, doesn't he?
We need more David Diggs. He needs to find his, I don't know what show would be, holiday special, tour of him singing some standards. I don't know. He is incredibly talented. Just really, really. And he owns the character. It's a tough character to... particularly with the other actor who played in the original animated film.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to overcome that. Of course, he has a Jamaican accent, Steve, because, you know, it's the Caribbean, Steve.
Misa, no like this.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it was played by Jar Jar Binks, but, you know. but nobody knows what he's doing these days, Steve. He's not really doing a lot these days.
But he did a great job as Sebastian.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. And Awkwafina plays Scuttle. Yes, I was trying to figure out who this was as I'm listening to it. Scuttle is confused and makes up all definitions. Let's just make sure we're clear with that.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, like I said, there's a song eventually by David Diggs and Awkwafina that I'm going, that doesn't sound like Howard Ashman. And that was Miranda. Our story is the story that you all remember. There's some new songs thrown in. I think everyone was incredibly happy with this film.
Okay.
Even the person who was behind me that was snoring, that was hilarious.
Even because, they, you know, were enjoying it.
Well, it's a 9 o'clock performance, Steve. they bring you food at the Alamo Draft House. And they have loungers that recline back. It's warm. And he's brought the kids. And they're really enjoying it. And he's getting a good snooze in. So he's happy too, Steve. Everyone is happy.
Does this suffer from comparison? Are you thinking the whole time that you're watching this about the original and about the choices that were made for this one?
All right. So I'm going to say 70 out of 100 for this film. Where we suffer on this film is the animation they use here is not as vibrant as what they used in the 80s.
Okay.
I, deep down, I don't know why they insist on making more realistic cartoon characters. It's not that enduring. When you're going through water, it's amazing in the sense of the technology, what we have. Mm-hmm. But just like all the other remakes, it's just kind of over the top realism in the animation. It doesn't help. But, you know, if you think back to Mary Poppins back in the 60s and Dick Van Dyke, who's totally owns an English accent in this film, he does a dance with penguins. He was dancing with animation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those were cartoonish. These are more like realistic. So this has always been part of Disney technology, telling stories. And I think the best way to consider every one of these remakes that uses more realistic animals to be their cartoons, just think of them as new productions and just recognize that that's what they are.
As a producer of stage work, I admire different productions on the stage. Every night could be very different from the previous night. And those actors putting that heart and soul into those characters is something I admire. With a movie, I'm always suffering from comparison. I'm always thinking about, well, they did that different. They maybe shouldn't have done that.
All right. So what I think is also going on is that these new productions keep the copyright in Disney's hand.
Okay.
And the original movie that Disney did, I mean, that's what, 35 years ago or so. So, I mean, it was for these young kids, it was a lifetime ago.
That's two generations, basically.
Yeah. I think Holly Bailey did an incredible job on this. The song that was cut, I do think I figured out the spot, was the funny fish chef song, the Le Poisson.
Oh, they cut that.
They did. Huh. And that's where we get the scuttlebutt song, I guess, is in the place of it. That's too bad, because that is such a great song.
A fun, silly song. Yeah.
Which is, Steve, the fish in Spanish French.
Is that another fish joke? We've got a lot of fish jokes in this episode. So I'm glad that you enjoyed that. I don't know that I will go to see this one. I don't have little grandkids to bring to this movie yet. So maybe when this comes out on video, maybe life will change and I will see The Little Mermaid. You also saw another movie with Sebastian. This is about my father. This is the story of an Italian immigrant father and all American lifestyle with Sebastian Maniscalco and his stand-up routine made into a movie.
This film, once again, was at the Alamo Draft House. It was a packed theater. So people were there. They were there to see this film. And there were a lot of chuckles going on through this film. So, you know, the demographics were a little bit older, Steve. In fact, a little older than me. But it didn't matter. Everyone was enjoying it. One day you're going to be in, I don't know, it's going to be some holiday or something. It's the end of the day. You've got all the grandparents and the kids together, the grandchildren together. And you're going to go, well, let's just kind of watch a movie. This is the type of movie that will hit multiple generations. Steve, we've got a butt that we get to see in this film. You know, there's a scene where the butt gets shown. Kids and adults, they laugh at butts, Steve. It's bodies.
Butts are always funny.
They're always funny, right? All right, but this is also a film that you have seen before. If you've been to a lot of films, if you watch Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers, This is very much that story. Ben Stiller's not the one basically going through the meat grinder. We get Sebastian Maniscalco going through that. He is the Italian. His father's the immigrant from Sicily, Steve, from Sicily. And Sebastian is the son that the father's you know, teaching them the way in Chicago, Steve, in Chicago.
But it is still Robert De Niro. It's the same father, but a different lifestyle here.
Yeah, but Robert De Niro is playing the Italian father.
Okay.
He's not playing the, I don't know what you describe him, the waspy father.
Okay.
What we also have is the budget of kind of like My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Okay.
So My Big Fat Greek Wedding happened in 2002. Uh-huh. By the way, Meet the Fockers was 2004.
That was the sequel to Meet the Parents. Uh-huh.
That's right. But just so you know, I mean, that was a lifetime ago for...
A generation, for sure.
Absolutely. So you see how these stories can be retold.
Yes.
So what is their story? So Sebastian wants to marry his waspy artist girlfriend, who is Leslie Bibb, and what they've been invited over 4th of July weekend to visit Virginia to go and meet the parents, right? And oh my goodness, Sebastian has to leave his father alone in Chicago. His father's a hairstylist, Robert De Niro. Italian hairstylist, just go with it. You know the trope, and Robert De Niro owns that.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Just think of the hairstyles. Yes, Robert De Niro owns that.
Okay.
They head off to, well, I'll call it Waspy, but Waspy we usually think of the Northeast. They head off to the Commonwealth of Virginia to the summer home of a senator and the husband who owns a chain of hotels. And we get invited into their very white world. And so we have a big brother who seems to have been introduced to every possible, golf, helicopter flying, any type of activity, skiing. It doesn't really matter. He's mastered those because his parents have had the resources to send him to do those. The joke that constantly comes up is, well, Dad, I thought you were going to give me that job. And Dad goes, hey, we drug test. And the son immediately backs down.
Okay.
So we get drug jokes here. And then we have the little brother who is just absolutely out there with all his most unusual activities. Steve, he is going to make music off of those rim glasses for everybody. He is becoming one with the universe. A moment of Zen is going to be him. Of course, he is equally out there because he was somehow abandoned. We've got the two parents who are the most supportive parents ever to their kids, to a fault. They don't let their kids fail, which means that they don't really get to live. And, of course, we've got Robert De Niro and Sebastian as, the Italians who are going to, before they go to bed, Steve, they put on some cologne. They spritz the cologne and they walk through it. Of course they do.
Oh boy.
They're Italian and they're in Chicago. And all of our humor is based off of putting these people in those positions.
Mm-hmm.
And it is funny. It's enjoyable. It's not particularly offensive. I mean, unless you're an Italian in Chicago, maybe it could be.
Okay.
But it's a celebration of sort of these cultures that most of us are not part of. And it's enjoyable. I say 50 out of 100. People left it. They had smiles on their face. It's not great. It's not bad.
Okay.
But it's enjoyable. It's something to walk through.
And you have no problem with the comedy stylings of Sebastian Maniscalco. He has been described as the Italian Dane Cook. Very over the top body movements, and that was funny for you.
Well, I mean, think of a 5-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Body movements are funny.
Yes, I got it.
Yeah. Of course they're funny. And for the general public, don't stop thinking of sophisticated mind person. Think of general public.
Yeah.
Entertainment. What's enjoyable? It's enjoyable to watch people enjoying themselves and being silly.
Okay.
We sort of miss these films. Maybe back in the 70s, we had a lot more of those where it was kind of like, we're going to go watch the Apple Dumpling Gang and Tim Conway and Don Knox are going to be really funny. And we go, oh yeah, they're really funny.
So you're telling me Kim Cattrall in this movie is a throwback to the 70s?
Yeah, she's the Waspy mother.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not exactly. Yes. Not exactly her role from other films, huh?
So to give it a true comparison to Meet the Fockers, these both have shock comedy, but Ben Stiller's character was truly put through the meat grinder in Meet the Fockers
mm-hmm.
on a very over-the-top way, certainly much funnier. But About My Father is going to be, I think people really misunderstand of how to connect to the general audience. This film connects to a general audience. It really is good.
All right.
Book it.
Book it.
Brings you to our book it, our book of the week. It is the end of the month and time to delve into literature on a high level. Pam Bedore is here. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, guys. How's it going?
It's fantastic. It is the end of May, and a teacher with a big smile on his face is the only way to be.
I will light my first cigarette, Steve. I'm in North Carolina. We are going to be talking French. French books.
Okay.
Well, this is going to be a long segment, kids. Sit back, strap in. Chip is on his French, and he's holding up an invisible cigarette. So we're ready.
And drinking lots of coffee.
Oh, dear.
So, Pam, it is your month to bring us a book for our book club. What have you brought us this month?
So I brought you Evrey Letellier's L'Anomalie, but we did read it in translation as The Anomaly. So I feel like you guys should say the word Evrey Letellier as often as possible throughout this podcast. Does that sound good?
All I'm going to say is Gomez would say, she spoke French.
French is always spoken louder, Steve. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, so you guys, I really need to know, because I read this book a couple months ago, and as I was reading it, I was like, oh, I want to know what Steve and Chip think about this book. But then I also thought, are they going to want to read this book? Because it is a weird one. So be honest with me. Am I apologizing to you guys? Are we apologizing to our listeners? Or was this kind of amazing?
This is a weird book. There is no doubt about it. This is a weird book that we are going to spoil this book. Before we get too far into this, the story of this in and of itself is a spoiler. So those of you who have any interest in reading The Anomaly, which, by the way, in English is pronounced The Anomaly, Pam.
L'Anomalie. And by the way, it did win Le Prix Goncourt.
Of course it did.
Which is a very, very prestigious French literary award. And so it's been translated into 37 languages. It only came out, it won the Le Prix Goncourt in 2020. So it has been getting a ton of press. We're going to hear about this. It's been optioned for a TV series. Like, it's a pretty interesting concept, but you're right. We have to spoil it right from the start.
So my spoiler answer to your question is I liked this book very much. This book is very much in the vein of stories that I like, a lot of pop culture references, and it is very much a Twilight Zone, what if kind of an examination of life, the universe, and everything. How about you, Chip?
There's a lot to like about this book. It is very French.
So I do apologize for bringing this book.
And so much. Maybe it's time to put on the lava lamp as we get started.
I knew Chip was going to get to the lava lamp. This is a philosophical journey. This is a journey into thinking. And I knew that Chip would really, really have a hard time with how we can possibly put together the reality plus the story of this book.
So relax the mind and let it wander as we discover the world of French literature.
What's the name of the book, Chip?
The Anomaly.
Perfect. That is perfect French. So once again, at this point, all bets are off. If you have not read The Anomaly, please go and read this book first before you listen to our conversation. This is an all spoilers month on the book club. So I'm going to let off the spoiler horn right now. Okay, so now, Pam, where do we start?
Well, one of the questions I had for you was, could you tell that this was a book in translation? Or if I said this book was written by James Johnson, I mean, a lot of it is set in the U.S.
It totally felt like I was trying, in fact, I had the person that I was thinking that was reading this, because there was, you know, it tells a story, but certainly it's not like a Hollywood writing story. This is certainly of a different culture and a different way of approaching something that we've read a lot of.
It feels like he was really trying to make a American story, though. I don't know how to describe it, but yes, there is a foreign feeling to this. I feel like it's written by somebody that I've never read before, somebody who I've never met before, but it feels like he's really trying, putting in those cultural references that I enjoy so much, that I knew that it was French, but I can't describe why.
Exactly. I felt that too, right? I absolutely felt that too, that, I mean, the setting is largely American, right? And I mean, people are moved, the flight goes from Paris to New York, but you know, you have some European characters, some American characters, but it still felt very European to me.
It's important to get perspectives that are not American. Yeah. That's the reason why we watch foreign films, because you watch a foreign film and something that is trope through Hollywood is looked at differently because it came from New Zealand, or it came from Australia, or it came from France, or wherever it came from Germany. All of a sudden, Uwe becomes Otto, and you know, it's just a little different.
I watched that movie this week. That movie came out pretty well. The Man Called Otto.
I watched it this week too. I loved it.
But it does have that same flair, yes, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Exactly right. Oh, yes. I hadn't made that connection. Thanks, you guys. But yes, I watched it this week too, and I enjoyed it so much. So with this novel, he really, there's like a sort of literary element to it, right? Where, you know, he delves into all these different people's consciousness. We don't stay with someone for very long. And that can be hard as a reader to move between all these people.
But it's some a good cold open. That was one of my first impressions, yes. was I am thrown into all of these little snippets of stories, and I'm understanding the little snippet very well, and I'm waiting for how do all of these snippets come together. And interestingly, he started with the trope of the hitman. And that is a very American trope for sure.
You Americans and your guns.
Right.
Although the hitman names himself Blake after William Blake, because he always loved those poems. And so William Blake, of course, the romanticist. So, I mean, even as a hitman, he's a little cultured. Yes. Right?
He is a man with a conscience, doing the unconscionable.
Blake was not a man with a conscience. I'm going to stop you right there, Jim. And I loved how he was like, and then Blake moved into a scenario with a total Dexter vibe. And I knew exactly, that was like such great shorthand. You can picture exactly how much plastic is in the room of a Dexter kill. So
I loved all of those little pop culture references. I loved the Waiting for Godot translated into Klingon. Thank you.
Yeah.
I would love to see a Klingon representation of the play Waiting for Godot. And just the mention of Waiting for Godot leads us to an understanding of what this story is going to be. This is going to be theater of the absurd, mm-hmm. making us thinking on a philosophical level about the fundamental nature of knowledge and reality. I love all of this so much.
Oh, tell me more about reality, Chip, Steve.
Chip gets out the lava lamp, and I get it.
Well, and it also speaks to, I feel like, us as audience members too, because we do get both of those references. Mm-hmm. we get the theater of the absurd and the Klingon. So, I mean, I think that's and that's a lot of people. It's so funny because when I got my PhD in 2005. A lot of people said, you're going to struggle to get a job because you're focusing on popular literature. Well, now everyone, just not even 20 years later, every new faculty member we hire, whether their PhD is in medieval literature, 18th century, transatlantic, or 20th century American, we're all expected to teach popular literature at some level. I mean, that, and I feel like this is a really good example of the sort of how much we have reduced the differences, reduced the barriers between canonical and popular lit.
Because the simulation has made that happen for you, Pam. Congratulations.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something exactly. to be said of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was growing up being a consumer of this because, you know, we had to go to school. It was as if much of the literature that we were exploring was from so long ago. Mm-hmm. And we ignored so much of the volumes of stuff coming out today. And mm-hmm. every once in a while, you have something that rises to this will of the ages or of the time. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that's important. It's important to be able to recognize that. How do you recognize that unless you are exploring pop culture?
Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the things that I think L'Atelier does really, really well is obviously the scenario is very sci-fi. He has tons of really? Sci-fi references.
Really?
We'll talk about Protocol 42, which is one of my favorites.
Thank you.
But at the same time, he frames the entire novel through these quotations from Victor Meisel. And the quotations are very literary. And Victor Meisel, of course, is a character in the novel. Mm-hmm. So using quotations written by a character in the novel that you're reading, that's postmodern. You know, I mean, that level of metafiction, using intertextuality from within is just about as postmodern as it gets. And so in some ways, like, this reminds you of South American magical realism trope. It reminds you of Paul Auster in the New York trilogy, kind of a standard detective postmodern. And then it also just reminds you of, like, time travel, sci-fi, multi-world. You know, it's all over the place. It's just drawing from so many places.
So if you are a consumer of pop culture today, and you recognize all those references, 100 years from now, or 200 years from now, would something be able to last? Because how would you have all those references?
Hmm.
I mean, we read Shakespeare. Shakespeare makes a lot of statements of, like, I don't know, things of the time, but somehow it's become part of our regular vocabulary at times.
And this is one of the anxieties I think that this novel really thinks about, is the fact that we no longer have, we know each other, we watch and think and read a lot of the same things. But if you just run into someone at, you know, at the airport, like, you might not have seen very many of the same things. Mm-hmm. You could be avid, you know, movie, TV, reader, consumer, and you could have very little overlap. Whereas when you and I were teenagers, we watched the exact same things as all our friends, because that's all there was to watch, right? So with the multiplication of content through both, you know, through networks, but also the multiplication of private content, of individual content through YouTube and TikTok, you know, we have far fewer shared references. And I think that that's one of the things that this novel is thinking about, is what happens if we keep multiplying our content, and then what if we multiply ourselves?
That reminds me of when I was a young man, back when I had hair.
oh my!
I sat across the table with a friend of mine and their family, and the mom was talking to us about the importance of reading bestsellers. And the importance of, you know, maybe watching films that are the bestsellers. Because even if you don't have interest in the MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe, or whatever the latest novel is, a lot of people have read it. So for a certain generation, making Harry Potter statements or Star Wars references or Lord of the Rings references or, you know, 1984 references, there's a culture there that you can kind of speak the shorthand that the general population gets. I guess as they move away from that, well, I guess that would be a tough way of doing it. But we all know if we said, you know, it's just a snap and it's going to make some changes, we go, oh, no, you know, that could be good for bad or good or bad.
And I've been talking about this for a long time. With my students, what I see is if they want to reference a TikTok, they have to show that TikTok to that person first before they can then have that conversation. That has changed. You know, we are not the water cooler standing, you know, oh, did you see last night's Cheers? You know, that culture of literature is very different in the 21st century.
That may be the power of sports, because that's the one thing that brings a large group of people together. And even though there's a group of people who do not care about sports,
correct?
You don't say.
But there is such, it's the only thing that gathers large numbers. If you wanted to advertise something to a large group of people and have them watching it, it's going to be the NFL game. You know, it's going to be, you know, whatever the NBA finals or whatever the latest thing is. Or as we like to say here in North Carolina, the Carolina Hurricanes.
Yeah, that's a really good point that sports is one of the few things that people watch at the same time. Okay, so in this novel, well, let's just say it, we have a bunch of people. We don't know how they're connected at first. It turns out they're all on the same flight that hit some very, very, very bad turbulence, but eventually landed safely. And then 3 months later, we have, from the perspective of the air traffic controllers, we have the flight showing up again. And it's the exact same flight with all the same people on it. So I must admit that I have told many, many people this scenario and asked all of my friends. So if you found out that a version of you from 3 months ago had just landed at the airport, how would you feel about that? And so let me ask you guys, Chip, are you excited to meet your double? Are you terrified? Where are you at? What's your perspective on that?
To meet perfection in person would be an honor.
Indeed. That's what I thought you might say.
As I humbly say that, no, that would be an interesting. I haven't really sat down and spent a lot of time, but that certainly would be an interesting part, because if you knew it was you or a version of you
from 3 months ago, you were a different person 3 months ago, mind you.
I could do twice as much work. I could be twice the person I am today. That I guess I would have to go pick me up. But I mean, not everyone would, but I mean, I would, I know all my good stuff about me. So I would say, oh yeah, we'll go, assuming this is the same person, let's go see what's going on.
Would your other you listen to you? Would your other you do what you said?
I just mentioned that, of course.
Okay, I've always wanted to meet somebody that would listen to Chip and do what Chip says.
They'd only do what I said.
Is it Chip, though? Is Chip the guy who would do that?
Is Chip the guy that would listen to Chip? That is an interesting question. I don't know that I'm the guy that would listen to me. I think that there would be some stress between two people that live in the same space. And we see that in this story. We see some very interesting combinations of this is the same person. How do we raise this child? How do we manage this lifestyle?
All I know is that if you went to a comedy show and there was one Steve laughing and then you heard a second Steve laughing.
Stereo.
Well, oh my goodness. What would you do?
Two idiots in stereo.
What about you, Steve? Would you be excited to meet yourself from 3 months ago?
I enjoy my own company to a degree, but to another degree, I find myself annoying. Whenever we talk about personalities in class, I always point out the guy that was in the dorm next door to mine that everybody said, oh, you two should be best friends. You're so alike. And we hate each other to this day, 30 years later, we still hate each other because he is so annoying.
Isn't that interesting? I hate no one, Steve.
I do not do well in a space where my personality is already occupied by somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I think I would have a hard time with literally myself. The one question that came up that I thought Chip was going to get to was the money aspect of this. If there are two people that are the same person, there's only one bank account. There's only one job. How do you manage the money part of that?
Well, you would have to figure out, you'd create an A and B, and you would have to, you know, at some point, these are two entities.
And split the money in half?
No, you would get another job.
No, but I love that Letellier actually has someone who's just about to retire, and he's like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Whereas with Slim Boy, the Nigerian rapper, he's like, this is the best. Like, I have a whole new act. The two of us, we're going to make tons of money. We're going to be so successful. We can do all these cool things with our voices. And it does kind of depend on where you are in your life, how difficult this will be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so I have to say that when I thought about this scenario, because I'm a bit of a crossroads. I've been a professor for 18 years. I'm 50. I'm expecting another 18 years. So I'm right in the middle. And I've been doing more admin and I love it. But I also do a lot of writing and I kind of like that. And it's hard to manage both. So when I thought of this scenario, I was like, oh, this would be amazing. Because this person could get a professor job. They have the exact same credentials as me. And we would totally be like best friends. You know, March Pam, June Pam, MP, JP, we would hang out. And we would, you know, one of us would get like an admin job. One of us would do more writing, but we could read each other's stuff. We could talk it through. It would
you
be
could
so much
edit
fun.
Each other's stuff. You could write together.
100%, right? And because you know, like yourself from 3 months ago, you know, like as a writing teacher, I always tell people, if there's time, and I hope there is, put your draft aside for a few days. Come back and read it with fresh eyes. You'll see things you didn't see as sure. You're writing it. So, I mean, I love the idea, but it was funny because as I told other people the concept, everyone was like, that's horrifying. I would want to kill that person. But of course, they would want to kill me. So, and I love that Letellier has the hitman mm-hmm. who's perfectly capable of killing the other self.
And does.
And the other self is like, yep, this is what I would have done. Yep. If I had known about it, damn it. And there's no way I can escape this death because I don't leave anything to chance. I'm a good hit.
This author explores every one of those possibilities so well. Like if this happened, if there were two of you, what would you do? And he goes through every scenario so well. Back to the one where the two moms have uh-huh. one kid, and the one kid, you know, is he going to be okay with this? Is he going to, you know, think that one of them is real and the other one is not? No, he's a kid. He's going to adapt and he'll be fine.
Yeah. And I mean, I always feel like, you know, we're all so pressured. We all have so many things going on. This would be a great way to like spend more time with your kids. Like you, I don't know. I do feel like, you know, how speculative fiction always is addressing some sort of sociocultural anxiety. I feel like that work-life balance is one of the things that this novel kind of is not the central concern because, you know, that's not a lava lamp issue, but it is something that you can think through using this scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a series of books of Protocol 42 is in the works here. I think that
isn't the best.
It's great. The fact that we just got through Towel Day and we're looking at how philosophy and science and culture come together. Douglas Adams absolutely is that writer for me that gives me those words, gives me that way of thinking about how we operate. And having a secret society, a shadow government, a group of people that are in charge of aliens, zombies, and anything else weird that happens, Mulder is on the line for sure.
Yes, that was so good. And it was such Like I felt like Letellier did such a nice job of he's moving us through all these people that were on the plane. He goes into the pilot's perspective, which is super compelling. And then he goes into the MIT, these MIT scientists who have been carrying a phone, a secret cell phone with them for 10 years in case there was a protocol that they hadn't considered, which they named Protocol 42, and no one realized how funny that was, except for everyone who's read Hitchhiker's Guide. So we knew it because we've read Hitchhiker's Guide. So, and I feel like, why do you think we are so attracted to that sort of disaster preparedness narrative alongside the disaster narrative? But I love the disaster preparedness narrative, and I bet you guys do too.
I think that's adulthood. I think we're always preparing. We are always, you know, what's happening today? What is today's, you know, thing? And are we ready? You know, do we have the emergency box in the car for the winter? Do we have the, you know, whatever it is that we are possibly needing?
I think that the day-to-day life is overwhelming. And let me light my next cigarette and say that somehow we think that going back to a more primitive time would be easier, and it wouldn't be. So
Right.
we have this idea that if we could just reset, everything would just fall into place and living a simpler life. But we really misunderstand that. Because guess what? In Ukraine, it's a simpler life. It's called survival. And most of us would prefer your day-to-day life to being in some survival moment.
Agreed.
And it's kind of self-fulfilling in a way, too, because if you're always on this edge, you're kind of working your brain that way. That's taking on stress of things that you can't control.
Anxiety, that anxiety of that speculation of what could happen certainly is real.
Yeah, I think a lot of young people experience that, and older people do too. I mean, I shouldn't, maybe we should say all people, but I mean, younger people, you see it at school because whether it's the test or whatever, just things seem overwhelming.
But things can seem overwhelming to middle-aged people too.
Yeah, which explains any number of things. It could explain substance abuse. It could explain just, you know, depression. Just any number of things you want to throw out there.
Getting in a van and going on a road trip just randomly. Hi, welcome to summer, everybody.
Oh, yeah. So now, within the novel, as we talked about, Letellier actually plays out a bunch of different scenarios, and he does a nice job using all these different characters. It kind of reminded me, Robert J. Sawyer does that in a lot of his books. Like, remember the book Flash Forward that we read, where he has all these different people who play out, you know, based on where they are in life, who they are, who experience a major disaster differently. And so I think Letellier did that really, really nicely. But then it goes so dark, right? And you can, I mean, I
Isn't that
don't
but life?
know. Exactly. So people are really mean to the duplicates. Society does not accept this insertion of a duplicate plane. And it gets really, really existential, right? And so, you know, how much, let me ask you, and Chip, I can already hear your response to this question. How much do you guys think about the simulation hypothesis,
Constantly. I think about it
constantly, right?
all the time. And my brain keeps saying to me, so what? If we're in a simulation, so what? You still have to pay your bills. You still have to go to work. You still have to do the things that you have to do. Even if this is true, even if there is a slim chance, which by the way, there's a very good chance that this is a simulation and we are all fake people. If that is true, so what?
Well,
How about
right.
you,
And
Chip?
yeah, you got to do it in the accent, man.
Jesus. What, so here's one of the great things to do. When the information would become apparent, as in undeniable, then at that point you can address it. Why spend time working on something that you have no control over?
Because we're imaginative humans.
No, but I mean, I deal with this at work all the time. They're like, Social Security may be here, Social Security may not be here. Mm-hmm. I'm running models. Okay, Social Security is here. If I run it without the model, it changes so much that your life is damaged. So yeah. I can't, when they change the law, change the rule, we address it. But there's, you know, mm-hmm. to spend your time worrying about something or focusing on something like that is not going to help your life or hurt it, but potentially could hurt your life. Seems mm-hmm. to be a very, you know, unless you are a person paid for those types of thoughts, seems to be a lot of wasted energy.
So when you run those simulations, do those people suffer?
Yes. Because if I came to you and I said, hey, you're saving, I don't know, $1,500 a month towards retirement, but now you got to save $5,000 a month towards retirement, that means that you don't get to go on the vacation that you thought about. Or so you...
Chip is the one running the simulations.
Those are just models.
Oh, they're only models.
Based
there's
on...
There's no...
Well, you're trying to show you're trying to show the hypocrisy of it. I'm showing you that if you don't take reality as reality, mm-hmm. that the decisions that you make could be harming your today life.
What about the future? What about the can't we doesn't somebody speak for the people that can't speak who are the people of the future? Oh, we've read that book already too.
Those people don't have rights.
One of my favorite takeaways from that book
absolutely untrue. But my point is that you can't spend your time. Those people, you are important today. The choices that you make are important. And to put people into crisis situations is not helpful.
Discounting the future for today. That's one of my favorite takeaways from that book that we read was what would somebody from 50 years from now tell us to do today? How would they change our activity today in order to live a better life 50 years from now? And yes, you're right. Living for today is much more important. The discounting of the future is important.
Well, first of all, I mean, that can be true. I mean, delayed goals are certainly something that people... can value. That's certainly how they achieve some things. But mm-hmm. we already have the answer to that. All you have to do is ask dying people of what they regret. Mm-hmm. And usually they regret a whole bunch of things. One of them is not spending time on things that they value.
Mm-hmm. So travel is one of those things that's on my mind all the time, because I see how even a story like this, that we see airline travel from France to New York and the cultural differences and the perspectives that you can gain from travel, for me, that's important today. That even if we're in a simulation, my simulation wants to go and travel. How about you, Pam? How often do you think about this existential possibility?
I mean, I feel like people have been thinking about the nature of reality for a long time, and with advances in artificial intelligence, it's perhaps become more part of the mainstream conversation. But in my mind, you know, people used to think that God made us mm-hmm. and was had whatever varying levels of control,
Pam,
right?
Pam, I still live in the South.
Okay, sorry, but okay, sorry. So,
go on.
Forgive me. So whether we were coded mm-hmm. by, you know, computer science of the future or created by a clockmaker god, isn't it kind of the same thing? You just mm-hmm. do what you do, right? I mean,
very much.
I'm not very troubled by it. I'm not very troubled by the idea that this could be a simulation. I'm piqued by it. Like, I find it intriguing and not very troubling, but I can understand how, you know, not everyone feels that same way. Because a lot of my pleasure is in, you know, intellectual conversations, right? And so whether you're a piece of code or a biological entity, you can still enjoy that. I feel like I have consciousness. So
whether or not I exist is a whole question. Since Pam has never met me, do I actually exist, or am I just an AI and we're having these conversations? And does that change the conversation?
You're just a cat in a box.
I don't think it changes the conversation. I don't think that our interaction changes based on whether or not I am made of meat or ions or exactly. or whatever else it is. And that's what I think about all the time. Yes, I went down a whole rabbit hole with this book. Thank you, Pam, for bringing me this book and bringing me down a giant rabbit hole. I started reading another book after this called Reality Plus.
Oh, my. Okay.
And in that book, the author, David Chalmers, goes on to express how even if we are a simulation, that's we are adding to our reality by adding other realities. That the
say that again.
The God model would be modeling down. Anything that God made would be one step below who that person is, where we are modeling up. We are going to some other reality after us. And that is a very interesting way of thinking.
I like that. Interesting.
Wow, man.
So
for sure, really.
I do think, you know, I'm hearing the term simulation hypothesis a lot more these days than I was even 5 or 10 years ago. And I think this is something, you know, postmodern literature starting really after World War II has been thinking about this question a lot with this sort of skepticism of the nature of reality. But it's really, with our advances in artificial intelligence, become, you know, increasingly what some people say, like, well, there's a 25% chance we live in a simulation, or, you know, whatever. People are putting numbers to it. I'm not sure how they're deriving those
numbers are all over the board. Everybody's got their own theory of that, and those numbers are all over the board. But yes, 25% chance is one of the numbers that I've heard. Yes.
Exactly. But then this novel, I think, obviously addresses that very, very head on. But then it addresses a lot of other sort of sociocultural anxieties that we have that are maybe more concrete than, you know, what is the nature of existence? Just reading like the airline disaster, which I thought he wrote extremely well. You could really feel the pilot's concern. And considering how many near misses we've had in recent, you know, airline travel, and the fact that airline travel is through the roof in terms of how many of us are traveling, that's a concrete concern. And then the idea that China didn't reveal that they too had a duplicate plane, like, that's I love that
detail.
oh, I wonder what he's saying. Imagine that. All right, so yeah, airline travel is the safest form of travel.
I know, of course, but it doesn't always feel that way when you're in a super turbulent situation and you feel very out of control.
Correct,
right?
And that's it. You're in a tube, flying in the air,
and you have no control as a passenger.
And sometimes you just need to relax and go to sleep.
Because it's all about control. And that's what this conversation about the simulation is too, is how much control do you have over your life, over your choices? Is there fate? Is it all set for you? And he goes into that very nicely in this book too.
So guys, you know my question. Did you guys like the ending?
I've been waiting for this since I read this book. I've been waiting for this moment where Pam goes, what about the ending? Because boy, oh boy, oh boy, is the ending of this book a Twilight Zone ending. It is very much that Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy philosophy of truth at the end.
Now, can I ask, did you guys do the audiobook or did you do a paper copy?
Audiobook.
I did the audio.
Same. So do you understand how it looked on the page? Because I did look it up because I was very, very curious.
No, tell us.
Okay. So, well, just so people know at the end, I mean, I loved this ending so much where a third plane appears.
And they shoot it down. A third plane appears and they shoot it down because they're not going through this again.
And I have to say, like, I didn't see that ending coming. Did you? I was thrilled. I didn't see it coming at all. And it
I
was
was absolutely thrilled
so
that
sad.
this author was able to draw, not only to draw that scenario, but to give it to us in such a way that we had to fill in so much of the detail to even understand exactly what was happening, because he does not spell it out.
Right. And so basically, so I thought the audiobook did a great job where as soon as the plane is shot down, basically the language starts, just
Stuttering and stopping, and it is no longer language.
exactly. And this reminded me of MT Anderson's Feed has a very different, but a sort of similar ending where the same phrase is repeated again and again, but smaller and smaller and smaller in the text, and they just have to sort of fade it out. But this is called a calligram. And of course, the book is written in French. I don't know how in the world people have translated this into 37 different languages. It's so basically what he does is there's the final page of the novel has le missing letters. So he starts out by pulling out one or two letters from each word, so that like halfway through the page, you can make out what it is, and then he takes out more and more missing letters with each line. And I guess there was a conversation. Nine different translators met with Evrard Letellier to talk about this, and he was like, "Oh no, there's a message there, but it's really hard to get anyone to tell." So he actually wrote a final page and then took letters out, and there's no way you can make out what the letters are at the end. So we don't really know what the ending is.
But we very clearly understand what he's saying is that the simulation gets shut down at that
Exactly.
point because the simulated people decided to shoot down that plane, thus ending that experiment.
Exactly. It's so satisfying. I just
Loved
love
it.
it so
Yeah.
That was incredibly clever.
Yes. Absolutely.
And also a puzzle. I mean, for all of us Dan Brown people, I mean, this
Yeah,
is exactly,
absolutely.
he didn't just write an ending. He had to think about how the letters would, which letters he would keep, how they would
Exactly.
end, and how ultimately the simulation ends.
I love this book, Pam. Thank you for bringing me a book that talks about Waiting for Godot translated into Klingon. I'm there for
You're
that
in.
anytime.
Oh my God.
Well, thank you so much for reading it, you guys. This was so much fun. So this has been a discussion of Evrard Letellier's L'Anomalie, or The Anomaly, published in 2021.
Zanamale.
Scroll a bit.
Brings you to our scroll with it. There's lots of things happening in the world. Let's talk about almost none of them. Let's talk about the streaming wars that are still raging on our computers, Chip.
So a couple of years ago, we had Netflix, which is basically the everything. From there, we got a number of competitors to come into the market. And then we had the next step, which was basically the mega sites were kind of put together. The mega streaming services were coming together. Disney Plus, HBO Max, Crackle.
You put Crackle on the list with Disney Plus and HBO Max.
Wasn't that that's Sony's version,
Yes.
right? Anyway, we get a whole bunch of them. Now we're getting the next level where we're starting to realize that brands are being dropped. We have Max that was presented last week. The response to that is Paramount Plus, which was CBS All Access, is going to combine with Showtime, which was originally a standalone app, to become Paramount Plus was Showtime, which just rolls off the tongue, Steve.
Branding. CBS. CBS great at branding.
And once again, why wouldn't these just be called HBO and the competitor be called Showtime?
CBS.
No, Showtime.
Paramount and Showtime are CBS properties. So
but
why?
But Showtime has a brand.
So does CBS. Paramount.
Okay.
Paramount does not. Paramount is the umbrella company for, you know, the Nickelodeons and the MTVs and all of the CBS things. The branding here is really off.
Yeah, a lot of them are off. But, you know, you have to recognize, in addition to that, to be confusing to a certain demographic that's not us, Steve, that's a little older, that young people have no connection to any of these other brands.
Right.
So I don't know if that's what they're doing, trying to connect to the 30-year-old. I'm trying to figure this out. I don't know. I think somebody's making some decisions going, this doesn't really have any value. And they don't realize that it's got like 40 years worth of history. Connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It could be Showtime featuring Paramount Movies, CBS, Nickelodeon, MTV, you know, Viacom properties or whatever. HBO could be, hey, we're HBO featuring Warner Brothers, featuring...
where are those connections? For sure.
Turner Classic Movies. Featuring our animation, right. DC, blah, blah, blah.
Because, you know, in my head, the Paramount channel is the Star Trek channel. That is what I own access to Paramount for, is Star Trek. Now, adding Showtime to that, I'm going to have access to a few other properties, some movies and things, but I'm still paying for Star Trek. That is what that's for me.
Well, Showtime has had a lot of series that have been introduced very similar to what HBO has.
Agreed.
Like The Sopranos and any number of the other ones.
Right. The one Showtime that I'm looking forward to is Yellow Jackets. When I get access to this Yellow Jackets show that I keep hearing about, now with Paramount, with Showtime, I'm going to be able to access that.
And that is, I mean, I think that's what the purpose of this is that Showtime is being lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because how many of these can you subscribe to? And it's going to $11.99 a month, right?
Correct. From $9.99 to $11.99 for the commercial-free version of Paramount Plus.
Which is very interesting because, like I said, this started out as CBS All Access.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of paying for an over-the-air network was certainly a very interesting thing. Peacock seems to be the one that's being lost here. And you know, the question is whether Hulu, which is owned by Disney, or a majority is owned by Disney, or Disney Plus is going to be able to take on the ABC stuff.
Did you see where Peacock was joking around with HBO Max? Yeah, if we lost the first half of our name, it would be offensive.
Uh-huh, exactly. Hey, Steve, we've got some news about Netflix and all those people who like to share their experiences watching films.
Isn't that important? Isn't sharing experiences watching films an important part of watching films, Chip? I mean, don't you want to watch Netflix with your family, even if they're, you know, not really family, but, you know, really, really good friends of yours?
Or their ex-friends, or their extended friends. You never know.
Or their friends' friends, or their ex-girlfriend's friends. Yes, Netflix is cracking down on password sharing, also known as some of us will not be watching Netflix.
Well, this is something that we've become very casual with. Mm-hmm. By the way, how many people have the pirate apps on their Roku sticks or on their Fire sticks or something of that nature?
Right.
Where they're pirating movies. We've become so, people have become so casual at stealing products and not thinking of it as stealing.
They justify it so easily in their minds that there are lots of places where you can find this material.
And let's make sure we're talking about middle America here. We're not talking about the group of people that are going into downtown Chicago and walking out of Target or the CVS or Walgreens with buckets full of stolen materials.
Not to mention the truckload of dimes that was stolen.
That's right. But the, you know, deep down, this is not any different.
Correct.
But we, my point being is Netflix has been very casual with it when their revenue was going bonkers.
Uh-huh.
But it, as their revenue, as competition has become more challenging and their revenue has been cut, I think this is going to, you know, I don't have a problem. I have kids in college, right?
Mm-hmm.
As our family has a Netflix account, having my daughters have access to it while they're in college seems perfectly reasonable to me.
Agreed.
We share Apple Music together. Some families share Spotify. You know, all those type things. Those are family kind of activities.
They are right? set up as family accounts. Spotify is a great example of that. I pay for a family account so that my family has access to that regardless of where they are.
But it wasn't really designed for you to share it with all your neighbors.
Right.
Okay. So this is where it's going to be more challenging because once again, if every time you have to go into an app, you have to sign in
mm-hmm.
and they're verifying that you are, I don't know, part of that, you know, that household. I had to switch over my HBO Max to Max. They updated the software, mm-hmm. which basically means you had to download a new app. By the way, that they redesigned the app. The app's actually much better than the HBO Max app, interestingly enough. But I had to, when I sign in, using QDR code, my phone and my my Apple TV, which I use, they have to be on the same network.
Hmm.
How about that?
Yeah, they certainly want to crack down on that revenue. They don't want to lose out on that revenue. And I get that. I understand that as a business decision. I don't know if it's going to work. I don't know if they're going to lose subscribers over this or if they're going to gain subscribers as they suspect they will. Time will tell.
Well, think about what they're going to be doing. Is they're going to be charging the person who has the original account.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you have a login in, you know, Hawaii. Are you traveling? No. We're charging you $8 a month. Mm-hmm. Do you want to continue? Well, that person's going to go, no.
Correct.
And that's how that's going to get going to be squashed a little bit.
And that's where I think they're going to lose money on this. I don't think that they're going to gain extra money. I don't think that those other account users will be paying for the Netflix. But we'll see.
Yeah, well, very similar to the NHL and what Wirtz, the family who owned the Blackhawks, the decisions they made.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're only, the only people that are important are the people who go home in Chicago and come to see an 8 o'clock show, Steve.
Yep.
Well, the NHL suffered because the Blackhawks had a very myopic business plan for local where the NHL could have benefited from having a strong Chicago brand.
Agreed.
The Blackhawks, Steve.
I agree.
Speaking of Chicago, Steve, and our sports leagues. Well, that's our intro right there. If you remember, Steve, Kevin Warren left for the Bears president position, Chicago Bears. He left the Big Ten, which is the Big Ten is located in Rosemont. Of course it is, Steve. There's no problems there. Do not look too deeply in that.
No.
Anyway, so this is a sports league. When Kevin Warren left, they had a whole bunch of TV contracts on the table that had not been finalized.
Hmm.
So the point on all that is these mega leagues that are being created right now. Well, it seems like that I think it's at least $70 million has to be paid back to one of the streaming providers of their sports content. How about that, Steve? Hmm. So this is getting, it's NFL light as far as the money is concern. And when I say light, it's significantly less than NFL, mm-hmm. but a lot more than many other leagues.
College football and basketball and all of these deals and all this money going around, this is definitely throwing a monkey wrench into it.
And there's a lot more of that going around, but we're not going to talk about here because we're not sports, Steve. But this is something to really follow. This is dictating how we're going to get our entertainment, particularly sports entertainment, going in the future and streaming. You know, if we remember last week, ESPN is looking at moving from cable to a standalone streaming provider. Mm-hmm. That's Disney once again. Let's see what ends up happening.
See what happens.
Steve, let's talk about magic.
Let's talk about magic and technology. This is the theme of my class all year round, is the line between magic and technology is your understanding. That is the difference. You found a story about a paralyzed man who has a Bluetooth connection between his brain and his spine and allows him to walk again.
He was paralyzed in a bicycling accident. And first of all, that means he's an athlete in general. So his brain may have been wired to be really receptive to this, but this is magic. This is a paralyzed person who is walking, and you know, it's a tender walk right now.
Sure.
But go out 10, 20 years from now.
What are we?
And that may just be a regular walk.
Yeah. Bluetooth has revolutionized computing just as much as USB revolutionized computing, changed the way that we use those connections. And your brain being an electrical appliance and your muscles receiving that electrical impulse, we can do some amazing things with our bodies as we go forward with all of this technology.
Yeah. Yes. Steve, television's been a big part of your life.
Yes.
And it looks like that Mike is finally going to retire. Carol wants something near the coast. And of course, all the kids have their own homes. Now they're not even living in homes. It's time to downsize, Steve.
One of them's a doctor.
What do you do?
Yeah, it's time to sell the Brady Bunch house. In Studio City, California, the Brady Bunch house is an icon. I've got a picture in our show notes of me standing outside the Brady Bunch house. Of course I do. They renovated it.
Were you bringing the meat, Steve?
Of course. Of course I was.
A lot of meatloaf, Steve.
Meatloaf sandwich. They renovated this house in Studio City in 2019. They did a whole reality show where they took this exterior that was the picture that was used for the Brady Bunch TV show, and they created this interior that is mimicking the studio set inside of this house. So now you, my friend, can buy the Brady Bunch house. It's listed for $5.5 million and it's ready for you in Studio City.
You can move right in. You could have your own Brady Bunch, Steve.
How many cats were involved with the Brady Bunch? Because that's the Brady Bunch that we have. It's a bunch of cats.
Steve, there was one dog, and he kind of went away.
and then it's
never spoken of again, Steve.
Then Cousin Oliver showed up. Maybe there's a werewolf connection there.
Possibly. Steve, sounds like you're home.
I'm ready. I am ready. Let's move into the Brady Bunch house and imagine all the people that will bother you all day long wanting to come inside and take a look. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we come back next week, Steve.
I think we can. We want to thank Pam Bedore for coming in for our monthly book club this week. It's so exciting. I don't think about the simulation all day, every day, but I think about the simulation all day, every day.
We're like the Scarecrow and the Wizard of Oz. We have brains now.
It took my arm and threw it over there. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
They took my arm and threw it over there. We'll see you in the future. What I want to think about.